to the new year and our new podcast, 2024. So who's more surprised than us that it's we've managed to make it into another year?
And we are now recording this more than halfway through January.
Yes,
which
that's
is unbelievable.
Right. I know.
It's simply a sign, Jane, of getting older. Time speeds up dramatically.
It does. And it's a very quiet Wigtown that we're recording this from. It is that time of year when there's not as many folk about. It gives booksellers an opportunity to go through their stock, which I think you're doing,
yes,
Ruth.
I'm having a big culling exercise, but the difficulty is it's all very well taking all these really rather nice books off the shelves, but it's finding somebody that will take them. And we don't want to put them into landfill.
No, certainly not.
If we can possibly help that.
Yes, yes. And as usual, we're here in New Chapter Books, and Lou and Briegel have had an amazing rejig of their back room,
yeah,
which just looks fabulous. So I hope you'll come and have a look and see what a cosy space it is. And what lovely books that they've got for sale. And Lou also is doing a rejig, because she's very talented that way, at Foggy Toddle Books too. She's rejigging the secondhand section there so that it's less confusing. Because there is an art to these things. I think it's quite difficult sometimes to know whether to go in alphabetical order or have different categories or... Or how to have them on the shelf. It's not a case with bookselling that you just, you know, stick them on a shelf and hope people will find them.
Pretty anal, actually, when it comes to fiction.
Right.
Strict alphabetical. Although I do divide the fiction into 20th and 21st century secondhand fiction, 19th century fiction. Crime fiction has a completely separate room.
Yes.
Fantasy and sci-fi also in a different section.
Uh-huh.
But all of the fiction strictly alphabetical.
Yes.
And Robin, who was working with me today when we were trying to clear out some of the poetry section, said, "You would have more energy, Ruth, if you stop complaining when you find a book out of alphabetical order." It's a real bugbear of mine.
Oh, right. Well, we generally have the new books are generally in. Well, they're broken down into picture books, early readers, confident readers, young adult, and the same.
I can understand that in the bookshop. Yeah,
and then the same to some, and the same in the secondhand section as well. But we've also got a lot of, you know, older collectibles, so we're actually putting those in a separate space. And then we've got other little breakdowns that have been suggested by Maggie McLean, who is one of the people who works for me as well. Maggie used to work for Blackwell's, I believe, in Edinburgh, so has come with that experience. Mm. So we've got a section of Puffins and an Enid Blyton section. And the only problem with breaking down sections like that is that when somebody asks you for a book, you've got to then remember, like Roald Dahl, you know, some editions are Puffins, so it's not going to be on alphabetically in your other section. It might be in the Puffins section. So that's the...
I find that, I mean, with the fiction, I've got the, you know, the Black Spine Penguins. Mm. They're in a separate section from the other classic 19th century literature. And I've also got Penguin Modern Classics in a different section and Oxford Classics in another section, Virago in another one.
Yes.
So you really do have to have a good idea what's in these sections. And if somebody comes in and asks, for example, for Gide, you know that you'll find that in the Penguin Modern Classic section rather than just the general.
Yes, yes.
So it all gets a bit confusing.
I know.
But we do our
best. And it's constantly changing and challenging and, you know.
And I suppose the main thing is, if somebody asks for a book and we have it in our respective shops, you've got to know where to find it.
That's right. That's right. I know, because I don't think any of us catalogue our books online. I certainly don't. I don't know that anybody does in the town, but maybe some of the booksellers do.
I'm occasionally asked in the shop, you know, do you have a catalogue in the shop? But it would be impossible.
Yes.
We don't have the time.
No.
But probably like Eugene, I find if somebody asks me for a title, I will know whether I have it or not.
Uh-huh.
I can't tell you everything that I've got, but I'm quite good at knowing what I don't have.
Right.
Because sometimes I think, but I should have a copy of that particular book.
So today, apart from that, we are going to talk about some of the books that we've been reading over Christmas and New Year. Mm-hmm. I know I've got a book from the box, and Lou has, I think. Have you got one as well?
No, didn't bring a book. I'm reading Emily Wilson's translation of the Iliad.
Right.
And what I'm trying to do is simply read, as everybody probably knows, both the Iliad and the Odyssey are rather artificially, but that's how it's always been done, divided into 24 books each.
Right.
So I'm trying to read a book a day.
I don't
always make it. I mean, a book's probably between about 600 and 750 lines of the poetry. So that's what I'm doing. And I've also been reading a Norwegian crime book, which I'm struggling with a bit. I do find sometimes that books which are translated, and I'm full of admiration for the skills of translation, but sometimes they don't always translate in a fluid way.
Right.
And I find that certainly with some of the Japanese translations, but that brings me on to the four books that I wanted to mention today.
Right.
Ones that I have not read yet.
Right.
But I'm going out to Australia.
Oh, yes.
For the month of February.
Uh-huh.
And I always take a selection of books with me, generally more than I need to take.
Mm-hmm.
And some I leave out there. Sometimes if I finish one on a flight, I'll give it to somebody else who just happens to be in the same flight. And then I generally bring back a substitute load.
All right.
Because there are books that are published out there that you cannot readily get here.
I would imagine.
So can I just very briefly tell you that the four I've chosen for the flight out, I'm hoping to get through the first two between Glasgow and Sydney.
Right.
One is Japanese. It's a Penguin Modern Classic. It's Kawabata Snow Country. It's just about 120 pages long, which is probably a nice length over which to concentrate when one is on a flight. The second one is one that I'd never heard of before. It's called Last House Before the Mountain. And it's, again, it's also in translation. It's by a woman called Monica Helfer and is translated by Gillian Davidson. It's set in Austria during the First World War.
All right.
Again, it's under 200 pages in length. Just looks very interesting. Got a lovely cover apart from anything else.
I'm
a bit of a sucker for a good cover.
Yes, yes.
And this one I got in an order last week. I got several copies and I've just lifted the last one off the shelf today. So it's obviously appealing to people who don't know anything about it, but there's something very attractive. So that's that one.
Sounds interesting.
My third one is one from the British Library Women Writers edition. It's 1 Year's Time and it's by Angela Milne,
right,
who was the niece of A.A. Milne.
Oh, really?
She only wrote the one novel.
Uh-huh.
And the blurb on the back says, warm, witty and surprising, it leaves you wondering why Milne only wrote one novel. So that made it rather attractive to me.
Yes.
So I've taken that
and
one.
And that's a lovely, do all those editions have that kind of cover?
Yeah, slightly embossed.
Oh, very
cover.
Nice.
Very nice.
Lovely pattern.
I stock quite a fair number of the British Library Women Writers.
Yes. That titles. Looks... So did you? When was that written then, in terms of how it compares with Winnie the Pooh?
It was published in 1942.
Right, so she was writing later.
She was a regular and highly regarded contributor to Punch, according to the the blurb, and in the 1930s, 40s, and 50s.
Oh.
So that's her time.
Wow, and that's very interesting.
The last one is one by Clare North. Now, I've never read any of Clare North's books, but this one is called The Pursuit of William Abbey, and it looks interesting. It's set, I think, in the 19th century, and it comes with the description that it's a novel about a young man haunted by a ghost from his past and by the dark crimes committed in the name of the British Empire. And, of course, there's a lot of stuff out there just now about the British Empire, how it operated, the awful things that were done in its name, and, of course, the fallout over the decades and, indeed, the centuries. So that's my four picks. I'll be coming into your shop, Jane,
right?
Because I have a grandson in Sydney who will be 2 in February while I'm out. So I want a nice selection of books from you. I've already, as you know, taken out 1 or 2 books before. But I think he's now probably getting to the stage where I hope that he will sit still long enough for his grabby, as he calls me, to read a few of the books that I'll choose from your show
very good.
Later this week. So that's at least one guaranteed sale
in
this rather quiet town.
Exactly,
this week.
Is. That's great. Before we talk about other books, did you want to say something about Kukubri Book Week, which will be when you're back, in March?
Yes.
Now, I'll let you say first. I've got an interest in Kukubri Book Week as well, which
you
I'll
have
mention.
Indeed. Yes, Kukubri Book Week, based in the town of Kukubri, which is about 30 miles from here, roughly, or maybe a little less than that.
A bit less.
25 miles, something like that.
Yeah.
Usually takes me about 40 minutes to get there, so I won't say anything about my speed. Beautiful town, famous for all the artistic links that it has. But between the 4th and the 10th of March this year, there is Kukubri Book Week with a variety of authors and speakers, a variety of events being held in the Selkirk Arms in Broughton House. If you've never been to Broughton House, well worth buying a ticket for the event just to get there. And the other venues in the town. There's beautiful galleries there, set in a lovely part of the country, of course, and lots of nice individual shops and cafes and small restaurants. So well worth a visit if you happen to be in the area. And the additional attraction for you and for us is that Lou from New Chapter, Jane, of course, who's with me at the moment from Foggy Toddle, and I are running a pop-up shop in some of the accommodation at the Selkirk Arms Hotel. The Selkirk Arms Hotel is a very warm, welcoming and attractive hostelry in the area. And Chris and Sue Walker, and I've only really dealt with Chris, very enthusiastic about the town and anything that they can do to help with the book week. And of course, as I've already said, some of the events are being held in the hotel itself. So we've no idea how it will work out, but we're looking forward to that. I think you are, Jane.
Yes.
Quite tricky to know what books to take with us for the pop-up, but we'll work that out.
Yes, we'll have to have a look through our boxes and things and our shelves. Yes, and I have an interest in Kukubri Book Week because Susie Briggs, one of my authors wearing my publishing hat, who just became the Scots Scriver for the National Library of Scotland. She was appointed just before Christmas, but she formally took the role last week. So she's very excited about that, and I will be publishing a picture book for younger children based on one of Susie's stories called Yum. So we're just finalising that at the moment and hoping to get it to the printers very shortly. But Susie's doing an event, but she'll be talking about her other books. She also, When I Was Wearing a Different Hat, published her books Nip Nebs and Nip Nebs and the Last Berry. And also I published Wished, which has illustrations by Wigtown's William Gorman. So she'll be talking about a few different things, but this that'll be nice for wee ones. Yes. It's in the library. And then also we have Donna Brewster, whose book I reissued last year, The House That Sugar Built, is giving a talk during Kakubri Book Week as well. So
The programme as a whole, I mean, it's not a huge programme.
No.
But it looks very interesting.
It does.
A nice mix. Quite a few crime books.
Yes,
people
quite
talking
a few
about
crime.
Writing fiction. Mm-hmm. And yes, I had another look before we met today, and I thought, yeah, this looks quite interesting. And there's no clash, so you'll be able to go to as many events as you want. And Karen Campbell,
is
speaking, so I do
right.
like to get to her event.
And there's a lovely bookshop in Kakubri, which opened just
two years ago.
Stuart
and Elizabeth.
Galavidia Books.
And they're sponsoring. They're part of the sponsorship for the book week. So that's great.
Yes. So you'll be busy when you get back.
Well, it's a question of getting off the plane and starting to pack the boxes, I think. But timing is never good in life, but you just have to cope with it, don't you?
So I'll mention a couple of books that that I was reading over Christmas. I'm now on to the fourth book of the Slough House series, which I'm getting from Ruth's shop.
That's right.
It's like a love in this, isn't it? But yes, it was only when I saw you put a post up about the books that I realised that the series that I'd been watching on Apple TV actually was based on a crime series by Mick Herron.
They're very well written. They're good.
Yes. So I was frantically reading, because I was trying to read the third one and wait until I'd read the right bit before I started on the, because I was watching the series as well. So it was a bit of a balancing act, because of course I was wanting to know what happened, but I was making myself read it first. There are a few differences, but the way they've changed the script for the text for television. But quite often you hear whole chunks that you've read.
Oh,
you know, they've kept very closely to the books in a lot of ways. So you hear that dialogue, and there's a lot of wry humour in it, and as well. So I actually read I read Real Tigers over Christmas and New Year. And strangely enough, the other book that I had finally got round to reading, which I had had in the shop on display for no real reason, because it's not a children's book, but just because it had a lovely cover. And then I thought, you know, I really should read this. And it also has Tiger in the title, oddly. It was just coincidence. And this is The Tiger in the Smoke by Marjorie Allingham.
Oh, yes.
And it's quite an unusual book, really. I have read, I think, one other Marjorie Allingham. And her he's not really a detective, but he's an amateur sleuth. Albert Campion was, I believe, she started writing this character really as a Mickey take of Lord Peter Wimsey. Originally, I believe that's... And I'm a huge fan of Dorothy L. Sayers and Lord Peter Wimsey, so I was like, oh, interesting. Anyway, I think she very quickly just developed him as his own character rather than bothering with him being a kind of send-up of Dorothy L. Sayers' character. But this book in particular is... He's not really sleuthing at all. It's more of a thriller, and it's quite
dark.
And quite a weird storyline as well, that at times it's difficult to fathom. It has some amazing kind of set pieces in it, these very odd characters. And it's all to do with whether this woman's husband is still alive or he was supposedly killed in the war. But then there's been sightings of him, and she's about to remarry. And so, you know, the police have got involved, and it's quite an intense.
I read it years ago, right. But I can't now remember.
No, I mean, at one point, the husband-to-be, the fiancé, has gone missing. And you discover that he'd tried to kind of work things out for himself. And he's ended up with this...
No, don't say too much.
No. but with a very strange group of people. And it's just, it's fascinating and grim and gritty and... which I wasn't really expecting. But on the other hand, those particular scenes where he's stuck with this group of people are just like walking through treacle. I have to say, in the end, I hate skipping, but I just thought it was the intense dialogue exchange of these people. And I was thinking, I just can't read this. You would get periods where the, you know, which you expect, like in The Slow Horses, there's a real momentum and you're desperate to read the next bit. Marjorie Allingham would create that, and then she would just suddenly, absolutely slow like it slow down to the point that you were like, oh, come on. I just want to know what happens. And I did. I don't like doing that. And I did actually skip. Because it was just driving me mad. I just could not read this dialogue between these geezers that were in this, you know, group.
But maybe we should ask those who are listening if they've read, to give us some feedback of what they thought.
Or recommend other Marjorie Allinghams, because this is it. It's not put me off reading another one, but... I would not want to read another one like that. Mm-hmm. But I think Albert Campion, he's really almost as an aside in this, rather than being, you know, a protagonist at all. He's just kind of there. It's definitely odd, but interesting. And then I just wanted to, I thought I'd mention another couple of books that I've just started reading, but one of them was A Christmas Gift. And I have quite an obsession with anything to do with the Arctic and Antarctic in terms of 19th century exploration. I have a bit of a thing about the Franklin Expedition. Mm-hmm. And a good friend, very kindly, and as a surprise, bought me... it's actually Parry's third edition for the discovery of a Northwest Passage in the years 1824 to 1825, which is about 20 years ahead of Franklin. And in fact, Parry, when they were going to do another expedition and Franklin was appointed, I believe he was something like the fifth person. They were not keen on sending him. He was quite elderly. In those terms, he was, I think, late 50s. He'd already done quite a bit of Arctic exploration, but not always successfully. And one time he nearly lost his entire party and they resorted to eating the leather of their boots to survive. So for most of his career, he was known as the man who ate his boots, his own boots. I believe Parry was either the first or second person that they went to say, would you lead this expedition? And he didn't. And then there was John Ross from Stranraer.
Northwest Castle.
Yes. Well, he'd been involved, obviously, hugely with trying to find the Northwest Passage. It was actually his nephew that they asked, but he'd recently married. And his wife wasn't keen on him because it was, you know, a very dangerous and treacherous thing to try and do as was proven by the Franklin expedition. Anyway, so this is earlier. So I've just started reading it, but it's just fascinating. So it's Parry's own account of the third voyage.
What's it called, Jane?
Parry's Third Voyage.
Right.
For the discovery of the Northwest Passage, with an account of the Eskimo, who are now obviously known as the Inuit. And it was published in 1894.
That's the first edition, isn't it? First published in 1894.
I don't know. It's edited from his first edition. And there's a biographical introduction. So I think there was an earlier edition. I'm only a little way through, but that ticks my boxes. And then I was also given, and I have to say I did request this, and actually it was a gift from my daughter, and it's the photographs of Lee Miller with a foreword by Kate Winslet, who I'm assuming they've filmed it now. There's obviously a biopic being done of Lee Miller. It's published by Thames and Hudson, and it's a lovely book. I've been a big fan of Lee Miller's photographer, 30s, 40s. She was involved with kind of Man Ray. Some of her early stuff is quite surreal. And then she went on to, she was actually with the troops, the American troops, during the war. And there's a famous, her and another photographer that she was travelling with, they came across one of Hitler's flats, and there's a famous picture of her in his bath, which went all around the world. She actually worked for Vogue, but a lot of them are about, you know, they're to do with the war. And like a lot of women who, you know, who did things like this and also served in the SOE, and I think kind of struggled a bit with just ordinary life afterwards. She married. She was married to a surrealist and photographer. And this book has been put together by her son, Anthony Penrose. So I've been joined by Lou now, who has brought... Is it a book you're currently reading?
No, this is... I wanted to talk about books, a set of books that I regularly go back to and just dip in and out of. Because they're an easy read, but a fantastical read.
Right.
So it's Douglas Adams and his Hitchhiker series. And the one that I've picked out, which is my favourite one, is So Long and Thanks for All the Fish.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. And I'm going to read Neil Gaiman's introduction to the new, well, the 2020 paperbacks by Pam Macmillan, I think.
All right.
Yeah, because, you know, he does it so much better than I would be able to. So this is just a little bit about Douglas Adams and about the book. Douglas Adams was tall. He was brilliant. I've met a handful of geniuses and I'd count him as one of them. He was a frustrated performer, a remarkable explainer, and communicator and enthusiast. He was an astonishing comic writer. He could craft sentences that changed the way a reader viewed the world and sum up complex and difficult issues in aptly chosen metaphors. He combined the trappings of science fiction with profound social commentary and a healthy sense of humour to create fresh worlds. He loved computers and was an astonishingly fine public speaker. What he was not, and this may seem somewhat odd, especially when you consider how many of them he wrote and sold and how famously well he wrote them, was a novelist. And this, I suspect, unarguably is the oddest of his novels. So Long and Thanks for All the Fish was Douglas's first attempt to write a novel from scratch.
Right.
It's part of its charm that So Long and Thanks for All the Fish reads as if it has not so much been plotted as stumbled upon or backed into. Well, It is surrealist in the way that a book extracted from the author without pause for inspection, for second thoughts or thousandth thoughts can only be. Characters appear and fade, dreamlike. Reality is frangible. The novel circles one event, a couple making love naked in the clouds, in perfect, flying, magical dream sex, an event that is practically a poem. I don't know if you're familiar, but every time I read that section, mm-hmm. I just cry. It's just amazing.
Yeah.
So Long and Thanks for All the Fish has, beneath the elegant veneer, the simplest, easiest, most traditional of plots. Boy meets girl, boy loses girl, boy finds girl, makes love to her in the clouds. It just sounds, you know, possible.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
And sets off with her to find God's final message to his creation.
Oh.
And does. After all, in a way. After all, for a book suffused from start to finish with gloom and melancholia, I can never say that word, a book in which the universe itself is fundamentally perverse when it is not actually malicious, So Long and Thanks for All the Fish is often peculiarly upbeat. Chapter 18, for example, gives us triumphantly something unseen in the Hitchhiker universe until now, transient and barely recognisable, but it's there, it's joy. And then he quotes from chapter 18. He hadn't realised that life speaks with a voice to you, a voice that brings you answers to the questions you continually ask of it, had never consciously detected it or recognised its tones till it now said something it had never said to him before, which was, yes. It's just, if you've not dipped into Douglas Adams' world, then you really must. And you can, it's number 4 in the series, in the trilogy. But you can read it on its own. You don't have to read the rest of them.
Yes, I was thinking, when you said the title, I thought I had read it. But then when you said the description, I thought, oh no, I don't think I have.
It's kind of the one that isn't science fictiony.
Well, that's that's why I was thinking that I had read it, but I don't remember.
But I mean, it is, they, you know, they go on their travels and everything. But
right,
it's just, it's a lovely book. It really
yes.
is. Yeah, fantastic. So yes, have a go if you haven't already.
Because I think most people probably maybe have just read Hitchhiker's Guide and kind of don't realise there's further books in the series. Then.
There are, and the Dirk Gently books as
yes.
well.
Oh, yes.
I think
yes.
there's only 2, but they're brilliant as well.
Oh, that's, I think I've read.
The Private
yes,
Investigator.
It's Dirk Gently, I think I've read.
Right.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah.
That would be why I didn't recognise that, the plot then. Yes, it is Dirk Gently that I've
read. And they're funny. And people have tried really over the years to make movies and TV.
Yes, they have.
But,
that's right. There
really
was a
successful
series, wasn't there?
There was. Of Dirk Gently. And, I mean, there's been a couple of, or maybe just the one, Hitchhikers.
Oh, no, I think there's been 2.
Has there been
there?
2?
Yes. Yes, because there was that more recent one, wasn't there? There was a series, quite a long time ago. And then...
There was, yeah. And the
wasn't,
radio.
Wasn't it the
there was
actor
one
who
on the
played
radio.
Was in The Hobbit? What's his name? And was also in Sherlock Holmes. Wasn't it that actor? I can see him wearing a dressing gown.
Oh, yes.
Yes.
It was. Oh, goodness. What's his name?
Oh,
sorry,
yes.
mate.
Anyway, yes. That
yeah.
actor.
That
who
him.
Was.
Yes.
Yes, who played Bilbo Baggins, didn't
yes.
he, in The Hobbit?
I wasn't
and
a fan
was
of the film,
Dr.
I must say.
Watson in Sherlock.
Exactly, yeah.
I'm sure he was in The Hitchhiker.
You're right, he was.
Galaxy.
He was,
oh,
yeah.
Hopefully his name will come to us before. So, yeah, if you're listening to this podcast, you're probably shouting at your... laptop or radio
him.
Or whatever it is you're listening on going, oh, for goodness sake.
I know.
His name is. Oh, food.
No, but people have tried over the years to do it. But I think the most successful was the original radio show.
Yes.
And yes. My mum introduced me to Douglas Adams through that radio show, I'm sure. So it must have been a fair few years ago.
That wasn't... Oh, no, I'm going to forget that name too now. In the original series, wasn't the depressed... Wasn't he a depressed robot?
Yes, Marvin.
Yes, wasn't he played by Alan Rickman?
Oh, I don't know.
Oh, I don't know. I'm
no, but it could have been. Yeah. Mm. I'm still trying to think of the name of the actor.
To shout at the, I know. I know, and all I can think is Bob Mortimer. That's getting in my... it's not. But they're a kind of similar size and shape. And that's... So that
gives you a clue.
I know. So that's just, do you know what I tend to be, if a name comes to me and it's the wrong one, I can't shift it. Anyway.
Is it Martin? Martin Freeman. There you
yes.
go.
Yes. Oh, well done. Oh, yeah. You get the top prize tonight for remembering his name.
Sorry, Mr. Freeman. We got there.
You're
in
very
the end.
Famous. We just couldn't remember your name for a moment.
And I've got a book from the box.
Oh, good. And then I've got a strange book from the box, which...
I'll go first.
Yes, if you want to go first.
This book is called Consult the Oracle or How to Read the Future.
Oh, that's what we need, at the start of 2024. Is it going to tell us when customers return to Wigtown? I hope.
Yeah.
Or is there anything we can do?
Well, it might. This one was published in 1900.
Right.
It was first published in 1899. This is the third impression that we've got. This was out of a box of a book by Ruth and I did.
Oh, yes.
The famous one where the van frightened me because yeah. it wouldn't go. And then would go really fast. So, and this was from that. It's by Gabriel Nostradamus.
Oh.
But,
right.
Yeah. And the contents, this is fantastic. The first one is we tell the meaning of your dreams, first chapter. Then we go on to omens, charms and spells for lovers.
Oh, I'll say.
I know. Then mysteries.
We'll bring that back for Valentine's.
For Valentine's.
Yes, you right, can okay. share some of the, yes, the charms.
Yeah.
We'll have to do a special Valentine's podcast.
I think we should.
Yeah, we'll do it when, mice will play while the cat's away.
That's right, Ruth's yes. not here. Yeah, because she'll just tut.
That's right.
A lot. about the fortunes of little people, fairies.
Oh.
Something important about days.
Right.
Fortunes told by cards.
Oh.
Cupid at work all the year round. So.
Oh, right.
Yeah. Chapter that. Characters shown by handwriting.
Oh, well, that's supposed to be something yeah. of a science, isn't it? Is that graphology?
Graphology, is it? Yeah. Married life begun as it should be.
Okay. Maybe draw a veil over that. Although it might be interesting if it's 1900, crikey, that might be interesting to know what it's supposed to be.
It goes on. There's more about fairy folk. Taking a hand at table turning. Now, is that like table tipping?
Oh, it could be. Yes, seances and such.
There's a chapter for those who live in the country.
Oh, we need that.
So I presume that's different, you know.
I would guess.
As to, I don't know. Protected by talismans and amulets.
Wow.
I know. It's great. Fantastic. It really is. So I've gone to the chapter on the meaning of your dreams.
Yes.
If you dream about a dog.
Uh-huh.
To dream of seeing a dog begging means that you will experience the misery of waiting and watching for favours from those who are farther advanced in life than you.
Oh, crikey.
So you would think that dreaming about a dog would be a nice thing, but no.
Oh, no. Watch out for that one.
Dust. If you dream about dust, not the Philip Pullman type of dust. For a girl to dream of being in a dusty house signifies that she will soon be called to keep in order the home of one to whom she has given her heart.
Oh,
so if you dream about dust, you're just about to get married.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. A young man, however,
dreaming
of dusty surroundings, is thereby warned that he is in danger of contracting a lifelong alliance with a girl who looks too much in the glass ever to be a good housekeeper.
Wow. Oh, dear. Aha.
A fountain. To dream of a fountain is a dream of bad omen. It signifies that you will soon enter upon a period very sad and sorrowful.
Oh.
When you will conclude that mankind is a tiresome pack and
good
be as
weak. This doesn't bode well.
And be as weary as can be of the monotony of existence.
Good heavens.
I mean, a fountain, you get all that from a fountain.
Heck, I wouldn't have thought that, would you? I think of fountains as being really lovely things.
I know.
That, and peaceful and calming and the sound of water.
Yeah, no,
but no, it's just, it's just life is pointless.
Oh, dear. We go to plants. There is mystery about plants. Excuse me, that's be post-it. Yeah, clover. Four-leaf clover brings luck to the person who finds it unawares.
Uh-huh.
The finder of a five-leaved didn't know there was such a thing.
No.
But, however, is sure to have bad luck.
Ooh.
So if you find a five-leaved, just pluck
ignore
a leaf.
It. Stamp on it,
Stamp on it.
Yes.
Oh, what else have we got here? Hazelnut. Mm-hmm. To find a double hazelnut or two nuts joined together is very fortunate.
Huh?
The double nut should be worn about the person as a charm.
Oh, right.
Yes. Okay.
In your pocket, presumably.
Oh, you know.
Oh, okay.
A little medallion of a hazelnut. Mistletoe. No one will be troubled with nightmare who hangs a piece of mistletoe at the head of his bed.
Right, so if that fountain comes into your dreams, get some mistletoe.
Get some mistletoe.
Immediately.
And it'll be all lovely again.
Yes.
There's a chapter on Cupid at work all the year round, but we're going to leave that
February. We'll do a Valentine's special.
Fortune, read in the palm of the hand. So there's a whole chapter here on palmistry. Many people regard palmistry as mere guesswork. This, it is not.
Oh, goodness. So, that's very authoritative.
I know.
It's
this
not.
Is all true.
Uh-huh.
I'm not going to read the whole chapter because... No. Oh. Taking a hand at table turning, I must... The influence of the evil eye.
Oh!
An allusion to the deadly power of the evil eye is found... Yeah, various ancient writers give accounts of people who possess this power to a wonderful extent. And then there's a whole chapter on the evil eye.
Hmm.
But I don't know if they tell you if you can actually give the evil eye.
No.
Not. See, some of this is, you know, quite dangerous, I think.
Yes.
You imagine in 1900, this was, you know, truth.
Yes.
Yeah.
And well, there was a lot of funny goings on in there.
Well, yeah, you'd...
I mean, there still is, I'm sure, but...
you can understand where the old wives' tales came from.
Yes, yeah.
And some of them... My mum used to scold me for putting shoes on the table.
Yes.
Because it was bad luck.
That's
but
right.
Obviously, it was not very hygienic
to
put shoes on the table.
Yes, and particularly new shoes.
Yeah, I don't know where the new shoes came from.
No, but yes.
Yeah. And my grandma crossed knives. She didn't like crossed knives.
No.
I don't know why, but she got very shaky about crossed knives.
Yes. I was told, and this is probably too much information, but my grandmother said you should never wash your hair when you're on your period.
Right.
You could die.
You could...
is what I was told. Yes. But, you know, she was a Victorian. I mean, she was 98 when she died. And she died about, I don't know, 20, 30 years ago. 30? Anyway, a long time ago.
Yeah.
So, yes, my grandmother was very elderly. But, yes, so she had quite a few of these things. Yeah. But that's the one, for some reason, that comes to mind.
Well, yeah. I mean, that would stay with you,
yes,
wouldn't it?
Yes. You were kind of dicing with death every time you washed your hair. Yeah.
It's a fascinating book. It really is. And some of it is funny.
Yeah.
Some of it is really quite disturbing.
Aha.
You know? And for a whole book to be... I suppose it's a little bit like the one I had the other day, the doctor's one, where you go into who was reading this type of book.
Yes.
And how seriously they were taking it. Uh-huh. I mean, you know, we're pinch of salting it here, but they would really take this to heart, you know.
Yes.
Yeah. Wonderful
and
book.
So it's not written by any one person, presume? Oh, yes, it was. It was Gabriel Nostradamus.
Yes. And it was given to or possibly bought by Ada Evelyn Sparrow.
Oh, right.
In October 1900.
Heck.
So Ada, yeah.
Yes.
Dreams, omens, spells, charms, astrology, second sight, thought reading, witches, wizards, soothsayers, lucky days and lucky numbers.
Ooh, that is fascinating.
Yeah. I quite liked finding that at the bottom of the box. That was a good one.
Uh-huh.
So that's my
book
for this podcast.
Well, I'll just mention just very briefly, because actually it's really not PC. I'm not sure whether it's a children's book or not. I mean, it's written like a children's book and it has a lot of curious illustrations. And I suppose it's more of the style of... do you remember that? This used to be played on the radio on Junior Choice. Do you remember that? And it was this. Was it Albert and the Lion? It was one of those long poems that was a forewarning to children. Do you remember? And this child is taken to see to a zoo or you know, and he keeps poking it with his stick. He's got a stick, and he's told not to.
Oh, right.
Anyway, yeah, the lion eats Albert. Yeah, anyway,
well,
so I don't... This is not from the same period there, from much earlier. This is from... bizarrely, it says... Oh, there we are, 1984. I actually thought it was earlier than that. I thought it... And it says, with apologies to Hilaire Belloc. And it's called Raspberries and Other Trifles, Tales for Discerning Delinquents by Jeremy Nicholas, who I seem to... Again, I have a vague memory of him being on the radio as like a comic raconteur or something, but I might be wrong. Again, somebody listening, hopefully, maybe shouting, and do have a look at it. We've set up a Facebook so you can kind of feed back to us if you've got more information as to any of the books that we've been talking about, but particularly if you know who Jeremy Nicholas is. Oh, wait a minute, it says at the front. Oh, but no, it's not telling you. It's a kind of jokey thing. And the illustrations are by a John Atlas Higham. But it's full of these little poems. And they're just really odd. You know, like one of them's to do with being a Conservative MP. There's... Dominic Formaldehyde, who addressed himself to male rights. He was half French. It's just curious. 1984. And it's, Alexander Filinoy, who suffered a serious blow. Quentin Courtney Carradine, who was made an offer he couldn't refuse. A nauseating little swine was Quentin Courtney Carradine, who, as his mother, as his name perhaps suggests, was one of Mother Nature's pests. I met him when I was quite small, a meeting I can still recall, for from the early age of 3, the lad decided he would be the sort of chap who makes life hell. And goodness, he succeeded well, a bully, sadist, snob and cad. He was, to put it simply, bad. And then there's another one called Monroe McFitt, who you can imagine is stereotypically Scottish. He had lots of money, but no fun.
Oh.
The miserly McFitts reside near Helensburgh on the Clyde. And their house is surrounded by a 12-foot electrified fence. And he made a fortune out of shipping, sacking men and asset stripping. That's very nice, isn't it? and then there's a very odd one. Well, they're all odd, as I've been saying. But this one's like, you know, I just don't think you'd get away with it. I suppose maybe it's a bit Roald Dahl-ish.
It is a little bit, yes. Yeah.
Peter Popinjay, who pestered pets and prospered. And in it, from then on, every vertebrate became the object of his hate. He started off with bugs and flies. Oblivious to their insect cries, he pulled their legs off one by one and found it enormous fun. And then he finds a cat, which he made useful as a cricket bat, a handy ball, a pair of stumps. It came up in all sorts of lumps. 3 overs later, it retired, and shortly after that, expired. So it's very unpleasant.
Not a nice book.
No, I know, but that's what I mean. It's really odd. And this is it. It's and evidently he really wants to kill a llama and turn it into burgers or something. But yes,
His name?
Jeremy Nicholas.
Jeremy.
Yes, Raspberries and Other Trifles. But yes, I'm not really. It's a book for, it says, all truly badly behaved, bad tempered children who will find much in common with these revolting characters. But yes, it does seem to be designed for children. But I certainly wouldn't show it to a child now.
Because they would. If they weren't before, they'd be bad tempered afterwards.
Yes, I think, I think children are quite sensitive about these things now, maybe. Yeah. Anyway. Yes. So if you've joined us, thank you very much for joining us. That's the end of this edition of the Booktown Blather. We will be doing another one during February, when we will feature some tips and hints from Lou's book on how to make Valentine's Day work for you, and I'm sure we'll be able to pick up some other love poems and things like that. Okay, so Happy New Year.
Happy New Year.